pray. It is it grips me again, Jesus, that one day I will get to see you face to face. And there you will declare your love for me, and I will declare my love for you, and we will be forever together in the kind of intimacy and depth of relationship that we only taste right now. But the fullness is coming, and it's all by your doing. I pray for these, my friends here gathered this morning, that you would move in their souls in a fresh and deep way, that we might taste afresh and anew this incredible grace gift of life that you have given. Let it be more than just truth that we grasp, but let the truth so permeate us that we taste and we feel and we experience and we hear in our own souls the cry of life that the Spirit gives because of the Son, and that it would be so much more real to us than anything else. You tell us we're supposed to taste and see that you are good. I'm asking for my friends this morning that you would move in our souls, that we would taste that and know that in fresh and deep ways. Lord, this morning as I stand here before these friends with some things to say, I'm humbled by your grace that invites me to speak. Because I know that it will not be my words that will encourage. It won't be my words that will nourish and nurture. It's going to be what you have to say to us through your word. I'm humbled that you give me the chance to speak, and I'm asking that you would take these little loaves and this little fish that I have brought to the meal, and that you would multiply them, and by grace and by your goodness and by your Spirit, that you would feed your people this morning. Give us ears to hear what you have to say. Thrill our hearts with a good word. And we will give you the honor that you are due for being Savior and Deliverer, Rescuer and Friend. You are our God, and we worship you today. Amen. It was quite some years ago, I was at dinner at a friend's house in California. He invited me over, and while we were waiting and he was preparing the meal, I was looking at some of the photographs he had hanging up in his living room, and one in particular caught my eye. It was rather strange. I could tell where he was in the picture because he was a rather well-built guy and bald, and so he stood out, and this picture looked like an unstaged photograph. It actually looked like it came from a security camera in a bank. I later found out that that's exactly where it came from. But it was the interior of a bank, and he was standing up kind of in this lunged position, and there were a bunch of people on the ground around him. And there was some large object flowing from his fingertips across the bank lobby, and I thought, what is this picture? And why is it here? And so as we sat down for dinner, I asked him, tell me about the picture that's hanging out in the living room. And he began to explain it to me. Sure enough, it was a bank picture. It was actually taken off of a security camera in a bank. And my friend was an LAPD SWAT officer. That is, he worked for the Los Angeles County Police Department and worked in the SWAT team. And he had gone to the bank one day to do his banking. And while he was in the bank, two armed guys broke in the front door of the bank and proceeded to rob the bank. Had everyone lay down on the ground and went from teller stand to teller stand, scooping up all the money, having the tellers give them all the money. And he explained that somebody must have tripped the silent alarm, because before they could get all the way through the bank, police cars with lights and sirens pull up in front of the bank. Well, now the two armed robbers decide they're going to head out the front door of the bank and take on the police. Well, as they head out the front door, my friend is thinking, the police out front don't know there's two guys with guns. They just know maybe there's one. And so he's thinking there's a risk if the second guy delays and goes out later. And he does. The second guy holds back. First guy goes out. You can hear the guns firing. and the second guy is about to proceed out after him. My friend decides, I got to do something about this. He stands up, reaches across the top of the teller counter, and picks up one of those big adding machines, and then hurls it across the bank lobby and nails the second robber as he goes out the door in the back of the head and lays him out cold. And I'm thinking, there is no way I would ever have done that. There is no way I could have... Not only would it have not crossed my mind, but knowing me and seeing him, there is no way I could have reached across, yanked the teller, adding machine out of its socket, and then hurled it with any kind of accuracy and got this guy going out the door. But that's what he did. And I asked him, well, what was going on there? What were you doing? What were you thinking? And it was interesting to hear him talk about it, because he was explaining, well, I didn't think about what I was going to do. It wasn't really about what I was going to do. I was just being myself. I'm a police officer. I'm a SWAT officer. My buddies are out there. I was just being myself in the midst of the moment. I thought that was amazing. He was just living who he was. My difficulty was I couldn't have ever seen myself living that way in that moment. Perhaps that's going to give you a window into what I want to talk about this morning. I want to touch on the difference between doing something and being someone. The difference between doing and being. He did what he did only because that's who he was. He was just being himself, and it came out that way. I could never have seen myself doing that very kind of thing. And I'm coming to realize that this difference between doing and being is really important when we talk about service. We've been talking about service for the past few weeks, and I'm coming to see that maybe serving is less about the what question and more about the who question. Less about the doing and maybe more about the being. Let me elaborate on that a little bit. If you've been here for the past couple of weeks, you realize we've been talking about service, talking about serving. We wanted to explore the whole idea about an environment of service and how it influences the way that we understand how we do church here. It's one of the components of what we think goes into building up this community of grace. The church, this church, Southside, is in a sense in the environmental development process. What we do, what we offer to those who come is environments. The truth is, we long for you to grow in your vertical relationship, your relationship with God, grow in your horizontal relationships, your relationships with one another, and grow in your ability to be an expression of the grace of God into the world around us, grow in serving. But I can't make you do any of those things. I cannot make you connect vitally with God and grow there. I cannot assign you and make you have relationships with other people. I cannot even get you to serve in a good way. I can't make you do that. And so what we want to do is create environments, that is, places and spaces in life where it is easy for you to draw close to God, like we do on Sunday mornings, and there engage with Him, grow in that relationship with Him. We want to create those environments where, whether it's connecting with God or connecting with others or giving your life away in grace, those environments are the places where you can, in fact, grow. God brings the growth, and we're looking to create environments where that growth is easy to happen. And we pause in our normal progression on a Sunday morning. If you've been with us for a while, you know that on a Sunday morning, typically we'll be moving through a passage of Scripture, a book of the Bible or a large section. And next week we will begin a journey through the life of Jacob. But we've taken a few weeks to just focus on this environment of service, because pause for a moment to talk a little bit about who we are as a church and what it is that we're after, because we want to make sure, in a sense, that we are all on the same page. And so we've been talking about service and this environment of service. And you may recall we began by talking about the fact that serving is not about doing for God. We're not interested in recruiting help because God's in short-handed or He needs assistance. Or if we don't come to His aid, His plan's not going to come through. So we're not talking about serving in terms of helping God out or adding something to Him. That's where we began when we talked about serving. And then we talked a little bit about how serving is the genuine giving myself away to others, expecting nothing in return. That is where the grace of God gets moved through my life into the lives of others. And then the past 2 weeks, Charlie's talked with us about how some of that is seen inside the walls of our community of faith, and some of that is seen outside the walls of our community of faith. And as I've been reflecting on this, it seems to me that there is one other facet of this idea of serving that needs to be touched on, something that inhibits me or keeps me from growing in my life of service, and it is this idea of thinking of serving as if it were about the what rather than about the who. And so I really want to explore that idea this morning and talk with you a little bit about why I think the who question is much more important than the what question. You see, when I talk about serving, or you talk about service, it's easy, I think, for all of us to think of serving in terms of tasks, stuff to do, things to do, the what. What needs to be done? What needs to be done? You give me a list of what needs to be done, and I'll choose what I would like to do out of what needs to be done, and then I'm serving. And then we talk about giving our lives away to others, expecting nothing in return, and doing it both inside and outside the walls. And I think it's easy to reduce that. So what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? We can reduce the whole idea of serving to the what question. What is it that you want me to do? When I really think it's more about a who question. It's not so much about whether you know what you're supposed to do, but whether it really comes home to our hearts that Jesus' intent is for us to see ourselves differently. That is, he wants to raise the who question and give us the right answer, and for us to understand that answer. I really think that when it comes to serving, the issue must move past what should I do or what could I do to who am I? And the answer is, you're a servant. It's not about what you do, it is who are you? And the answer to the question who is that I'm a servant. When we serve others, when we serve in any way in the Spirit and out of relationship with Jesus and in line with the gospel, that is, when the serving is consistent with this truth of the gospel and our new life, then serving is really much more about who I understand myself to be and how that flows into my life rather than what needs to get done. Serving really is a who question. And not a what question as much. Let me take you to a couple of places in the Gospels where Jesus has been drawing my thinking and changing my thinking a little bit about this. I'm going to take you to a passage from Mark, and I'm going to take you to a passage from John. And both of the passages actually come about in the same time in Jesus' life and ministry. Jesus has been walking with a group of disciples for a period of time. He ministers to a whole large group, but then he's drawn a smaller group that has been hanging with him tighter, and he's been pouring his life into these 12. And to these 12, he's been explaining more about what does it mean to share this life with me? What does it mean to have this kind of life that I have? And he's been explaining that to them. And he's been explaining that, in fact, life may not go exactly as you think. You have expectations about me, but I'm letting you know that we're going to go to Jerusalem and I'm going to give my life. I'm going to be betrayed. I'm going to die. I'm going to rise. This inner circle of disciples has a hard problem with that. That's not quite how they think it's supposed to be playing out. He's dying. He's going away. This is troubling to them, and they're wrestling with this. And it skews, it shapes the way they're thinking about, well, what does it mean then to be Jesus, to be partnering with you and what it is that you're doing and if you're leaving? And so there are a lot of questions that they're wrestling with. And one of the things that percolates to the surface among this group of 12 is greatness. They start talking about greatness. And for them, greatness is place and position and priority in the kingdom. Well, Jesus, your kingdom is, you're establishing your kingdom and you're involving us in what you're doing. And so what's my role? What's my place? How great a place will I have? And the disciples are wrestling with how to jockey for the plum positions in the kingdom so that they'll have standing in the presence of others by having the right position in the kingdom. And so that's what they are talking about. They're talking about greatness and position and authority and ruling. And right in the midst of that conversation, Jesus says, well, guys, I have something to tell you. You may not be seeing it quite right, and that's where we pick up the conversation in Mark, the Gospel of Mark, chapter 10. If you have a copy of the Scriptures, I'll encourage you to open there. Mark chapter 10. As this wrestling with greatness and the issue of place and priority is going on, Jesus speaks to them. Chapter 10, verse 42. Jesus called his friends and followers to him, and he says to them, "Now you know, those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles, they lord it over. And their great ones exercise authority over them." It's like they throw their weight around. They rule by right and might. They have their way that way. But verse 43, "But it's not going to be that way among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever should be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." Now, there's so much to be unpacked here, but let me just focus on a couple of things. First, notice that Jesus doesn't say it's wrong to want to be great. I think that's important to notice. When the disciples are struggling for greatness, Jesus says, hey, if anyone wants to be great, it's okay. You just have to make sure that you measure greatness the right way. I think that's important to recognize. Jesus is not inviting us to hold back. be uninvolved, not to live deeply in the kingdom. He says, no, if you want to be great, if you want to be significant, if you want to live well in the kingdom, welcome, come on. Just make sure you measure it rightly. And he explains how we measure greatness rightly in the kingdom. He says, if you want to be great in the kingdom, then it has everything to do with serving. And did you notice, Jesus speaks about being a servant and being a slave. I think that's significant. He doesn't focus on doing servile things. As if he were saying, well, try to act like a servant from time to time and that'll get you credit in the kingdom. From time to time, act like you're a servant or do serving kind of things. That's not what he's saying. The truth is, that's sometimes how I understand serving. That's how I approach serving. I look at my life and then every once in a while I realize, well, to be a Christian, it really needs to be like Jesus, and Jesus is, does things that I don't do. And so sometimes, in the midst of my very busy life, I will act like a servant. I'll do a serving thing, a random act of kindness. I will go out of my way for somebody. I'll do something thinking it'll do them good, it'll do me good. I think I'll act like a servant. I will serve in some way. But I don't think that's what Jesus is saying here. I don't think he's saying act like a servant, sometimes do serving kind of things. I think what he is saying is that life in the kingdom is measured by being a servant. It's about who you really are, who you see yourself to be. And the reason why being a servant is the measurement of greatness in the kingdom is because the king of the kingdom is a servant. You got to hear this. The king of the kingdom doesn't just sometimes serve. Jesus doesn't sometimes serve. Jesus is a servant. So when he serves, it's an expression of who he is. It just flows out of his life. And what he is saying, I think, is that life in the kingdom is measured by being a servant because the king of the kingdom is a servant. I don't think that Jesus lays down his life for us because he needs something to do. It's boring. I got lots of time today. I need some. I think I'll lay down my life. No, I think the laying down of his life is an expression of who he really is. I do not think that Jesus was trying to get in good with the Father and looking for something to do. Father, what could I do in order to get in good with you? Maybe I could serve people. Would that be all right? No, I think when Jesus talks about himself being a servant, he's talking about who he really is. When he talks about coming and he says that the Son of Man has come not to be served, but to serve and to give his life in ransom, he's not telling us, I'm putting on an act, I'm pretending, I'm just doing this for a while. This is genuinely, really who Jesus is. He is a servant. And laying down his life for us in serving is, in fact, the expression of who he is. Jesus' greatness in the kingdom is open for you. And the truth is, he is the greatest in the kingdom. If you think about that, if we talk to people about, well, why is Jesus so great? Sometimes people talk about Jesus' great power. It's true, he has great power. Jesus has authority and Jesus has might and he has right to rule. But the truth is, Jesus is not the greatest in the kingdom because he has power and might and right to rule. Jesus is the greatest in the kingdom because with that power and with that might and with that right to rule, what does he do? He serves. That's what he does. He serves. He's the greatest in the kingdom, not because he's more powerful than us or more mighty than us, though those are true, but he is greatest in the kingdom because he's better than us. He is more a servant than us. And he says this is how greatness is measured in the kingdom. It is about serving. Jesus is a servant, and you need to hear, if you want to experience life with Jesus, then you're going to have to find yourself with him as servant. We must understand that he's inviting us into his life, and his life is the life of a servant. It's not a life of something else, somebody who occasionally serves. Jesus' life is the life of a servant. And the reason then that measuring greatness in the kingdom is measured by being a servant is because that's who he is. I think this is really critical for us to understand. When Jesus thinks about himself in relationship to the Father, and Jesus thinks about himself in relationship to you and me, he thinks about himself as servant. That staggers me. But that's how he understands himself. I'm a servant. Thus, serving is an expression of who he is. Well, not for me. Not for me most of the time. I think about myself as just about anything but a servant. And then when I do think of serving somebody, I think in terms of doing something so that I could act like a servant, because because somewhere in the back of my mind, I think that's a good thing to do, and I probably should do that kind of thing, but it's not really who I am. I'm just doing that because it is a good thing to do, and Christians should do good things, so I should serve from time to time. But that doesn't flow genuinely out of how I understand myself. That is something that gets pasted on the front of me. Christians should serve. So I should serve. Christians should do good things. I should do good things. And that's not how it is with Jesus. Jesus serves because that is who he is. It's like when you think about coming to a worship service. We create this environment, this place and space where we invite you to worship. I do not anticipate or expect that you should come to act like a worshiper. We don't want you to come and merely sing songs. Act like you're a worshiper. Come here and go, oh, they're singing songs. I think I should sing songs. That would be wrong. What we want to do is create an environment where who you really are, and here's the truth, you really are a worshiper. You really are a worshiper. That's what God has done in giving you this new life. Back in the Old Testament, in Ezekiel and in Jeremiah, God talks about the new covenant. And he says, I'm going to take out your old heart that didn't love me, and I'm going to put in a new heart that really loves me. And hence, he is transforming you into a worshiper. And so when we have environments like this, spaces and times like this, we're simply giving you the opportunity to be who you really are. You really are a worshiper. I don't want you to act like you are a worshiper. I want you to worship, because that's who you are. You're a worshiper. And hence, when you serve, we're not asking you to act like a servant. I'm not asking you to do serving kind of things. When we talk about an environment of service, we're talking about giving you the opportunity to just be who you are. Because who you really are is a servant. Because that's the life of Jesus, and he's poured that life into you. Just like you really are a worshiper, we want to cultivate that. You really are a servant. I mean, if you're sharing the life of Jesus, that's his life. He doesn't have a different life to give you. He gives you the life of a servant. And we're inviting you to live genuinely there. Being a servant, then, could actually express who you really are. Let's look at another example. Go with me to John chapter 13. This takes place about the same time, same evening, same wrestling, same questions. Jesus' closest friends are arguing about greatness, and Jesus is thinking about all together different kinds of things. John chapter 13, starting in verse 1. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, when the devil had already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand, and that he had come from God and was going back to God, he rose from supper. He laid aside his outer garments, and taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet, and to wipe them with the towel with which he wrapped with. And he came to Simon Peter, who said to him, Lord, do you wash my feet? And Jesus answered and said, What I'm doing you don't understand, Peter. But afterwards you'll understand. But Peter said to him, You shall never wash my feet. And Jesus answered and said, Well, Peter, if I don't wash you, you don't share my life. And so Simon Peter said, Well, Lord, then not my feet only, but my head and my hands. And Jesus said to him, Well, the one who is bathed does not need to wash, Peter, except for his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not every one of you. For he knew who was to betray him, and that was why he said, Not all of you are clean. When he had washed their feet and put on his outer garments and resumed his place, this is what he said to them. Do you understand what I've done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I, then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I've given you an example, that you should also do just as I've done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is no greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. Now, some of you know a little bit about the foot washing practice in Jesus' day. When you came in for a meal, you didn't just wash your hands. Typically, you wash your feet or have your feet washed. Part of that is because of the way that you took a meal there. You didn't actually pull up to a nice table and stick your feet under the table, sitting in a chair. And you didn't wear nice closed-toed shoes, so if they were dirty, you could kick them off. You'd wear sandals traveling from place to place in Jesus' day, so when you'd come into the home, your feet would be filthy dirty. And then when you came to dinner, you'd recline, you'd lie down at dinner. You wouldn't sit. The table would be low, and there'd be pillows all around, and you'd lean on a pillow with one arm, and you'd eat with the other arm, and your feet would be sticking out alongside the table, and somebody's head would be right up close to your feet while they were eating. And so it was common practice to have feet washed before you ate. But that was a demeaning task. That was a really, I mean, not everybody would wash feet. In fact, if a house had a number of servants, it was always the lowest servant that had the privilege of washing feet. Well, this is a rented room where Jesus is meeting with his 12. They don't live there. There aren't servants there. The room didn't come with servants. It was just a room that they were meeting together with, and none of them have servants. So as they gather and they're about to eat, now we have this problem. The feet aren't washed and they're about to eat. Why has no one washed the feet? Why, in fact, is Jesus seemingly the only one free to do this? I'm going to suggest that the only reason why Jesus was free to do this is because he fundamentally saw himself as servant. And none of them did. They all thought it was about the what? The what? Somebody ought to wash feet. Who's going to wash feet? Somebody ought to wash feet. They're debating who's the greatest. Not a one of them are thinking in terms of themselves as servants, so there's no way that any of them are going to wash feet. But what does Jesus do? Jesus washes feet. How can he do that? He does that, I think, because he fundamentally sees himself as servant. Hey, feet are dirty. Feet need to be washed before the meal. Somebody needs to wash the feet. A servant should do that. Jesus, I'm a servant. Of course I'll do that. Jesus is free to wash the feet because that's how he sees himself. The 12 are wrestling with whether they should do the task. It's not a problem for Jesus because Jesus saw himself as a servant. He did what he did because it flowed out of who he was. The serving flowed out of his understanding of himself as servant. It was a who question that got answered, not a what question. Notice, it's amazing to me. I read this. And it says that Jesus, knowing that he was going to depart out of this world and go to the Father, knowing that the Father had given everything into his hands, knowing that he'd come from God and gone back to God, Jesus has incredible cosmic power. What does he do with it? He serves. Isn't that amazing? What would you do with incredible cosmic power? I don't know what. I'd try to see how many people I get to serve me. Seriously? I mean, in my better moments, I might lift a finger and help somebody. But you see, the truth is, think about it this way. The reason why the Father can trust the Son with incredible cosmic power, because he does all the right things with it, he serves. And why does he serve? Because that is who he is. That is who he is. Ultimately, the apostles are entrusted with great power. Why? Because I think they finally got it. Oh, I'm a servant. And if I understand myself as a servant, then in fact I can be trusted with this great power. Notice how Jesus says, he goes on to say, do you understand what I've done for you? I've given you an example. But I don't think this means that Jesus is saying, let's see, what could I do to drive home this point here? I could take water and splash it in everybody's face. Did I make a point? Wrong point. You know, maybe I could tell jokes and they would see that I'm... It's not like he's looking for an example, something to do, like he's looking for a teaching point. Jesus serves because that's who he really is. And then he says, hey guys, did you get that? That's me serving you. That's who I am. And if you want this life with me, that's the kind of life I'm inviting you into. That's what he means by an example. He's not saying, I did this, you ought to do this. He's saying, I'm this kind of person. I'm inviting you to be this kind of people. Washing of feet was merely an expression of Jesus' understanding of himself as a servant. It wasn't about the what as much as it was about the who. And if you want to walk with Jesus, if you want life with Jesus, if you want to experience Jesus' life, then you're going to have to begin to see yourself as servant also, because that's the kind of life that is his. Jesus intends for us to understand our lives as wrapped up in his life, and fundamentally he is servant. He's reshaping our souls to be servants with him, servants just like him. This may mean that there will be times, there will be specific places where you gather together with others and you do something specific, whether inside the walls or outside of the walls, where you give yourself to some specific expression of serving, whether it's on a short-term mission trip or serving in the children's ministry. But those serving moments are supposed to be expressions of who you are. Not merely things that get pasted on to do. Because in fact, if you do them just as if they're pasted on things to do, then you miss the understanding of what servanthood is all about. Servanthood is about who you are. and how you see yourself. We need to come to see serving not so much about something that we do, but an expression of who we are. And not, you got to hear me, not because God needs workers. We saw that in the first message in this series. Not because God needs help getting stuff done, but because living as a servant is the most genuine expression of the new person that I am in Christ. Do you understand that? Living as a servant is the most genuine expression of this new life that Jesus is giving me, because that's who He is. When I live as a servant, then His life best flows out of me, because that's who He is. And if I want to experience His life, that's who He is, then I live in this new identity as servant, and His life as servant flows through me. That's the most genuine expression of this life. I see myself as He sees Himself. So I've been wrestling with this all week and trying to get my arms around this whole idea about the difference between doing serving and being a servant. And it's freeing. But it raises some interesting questions. So I had some questions, and here's the first question. Wait. If I saw myself fundamentally as a servant, is there not a risk that I might be taken advantage of? And the answer to that question is, yep. If you see yourself fundamentally as a servant, there is a risk you might be taken advantage of. I mean, just think about Jesus. He did the right thing. He honored God. He served others. He sought the Father's glory, and they killed Him for it. He fed thousands at one time because He was a servant. And after 3.5 years of the most amazing, astounding ministry of service that the world has ever seen, there were 120 who chose to be identified with Him. What happened to the thousands that He served? They just ate their meals and left. He got taken advantage of in that sense. And in fact, Peter, I think, understands this. Look at how Peter says this in his epistle. 1 Peter chapter 2. Peter offers a little observation about living as servants. He actually picks up on the example of a servant, a slave-master relationship. And he's going to give us an example in a slave-master relationship and then show us how it fits into the model of Jesus that we're talking about here. In 1 Peter chapter 2. Servants, this is chapter 2, verse 18. I'm sorry, 1 Peter 2, 18. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. Whoa. I don't like that. He says, when you serve as a servant to those who treat you well and to even those who treat me poorly. Verse 19. For this is a gracious thing when, mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? If you do bad and you get bad for it, Peter goes, big deal. You get what you deserve. But then look at what he says. But if when you do good and suffer for it and you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. You serve and you don't get treated well for it. Peter goes, that's gracious. That's wonderful. Why? Verse 21, for to this you have been called. Oh my goodness. I have been called to serve and be unappreciated? That's what it sounds like. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in His footsteps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in His mouth. When He was reviled, He did not revile in return. When He suffered, He did not threaten, but continued to entrust Himself to the one who judges righteously. Wow. Jesus served, got taken advantage of by it, and He kept on doing it. And so Peter says, you all get to serve in the same way. What does that mean? That may mean, my goodness, that might mean in some relationships when I am genuinely understanding myself as servant, first and foremost, that I might get taken advantage of. Yes, that is in fact the case. If you in your marriage understand yourself primarily as servant, your spouse might take advantage of you. He or she might. When you come home at the end of the day and you've had a really long day and you step in through the door, what's your first thought? How are you coming home? I'm king of the castle. That's how you're coming home? You will respond to wife and family one way. If you come home knowing that your identity is fundamentally servant, and you walk into the house entirely different. You're very close to the life of Jesus there. If when, in fact, your spouse comes home, your anticipation is, well, what can I say and do to make sure that he or she serves me? Then fundamentally, your understanding of yourself is not servant. You think the game is to get them to be the servant, and we do that. What about at your work? You may be the boss, but why does God have you in that position?
Well, of course, it's to get people to do what I want them to do.
Well, maybe. But maybe if you'd like to grow up to look like Jesus, maybe he's got you in that position because there are ways you're going to serve people. Because your identity is primarily that of servant wherever you go. Serving is not something that we put on and put off, that we do sometimes. Oh, my goodness, that is how I live it, though. I'm in relationships and I want them to be fair. If you live in a relationship and you're a servant, you won't be treated fairly. Servants don't get treated fair. Right? You go to a nice restaurant and you're sitting there and the waiter comes up and he serves you, right? Do you turn around and offer him a plate of food that you just got? Well, of course not. That's not fair. How come I get to eat and he doesn't get to eat? Because he's the servant. Might you be taken advantage of if you're a servant? Yes, I think so. What about with your roommate in college when you step into the dorm room? Why are you there? Well, I'm there to study. Are you there to serve? You don't know the way that my roommate keeps his, her college room. I got to make sure that he starts picking up, she starts picking up. I'm not saying that you can't talk about those things, but it's going to be shaped by how you fundamentally understand yourself. If you understand yourself fundamentally as a servant, then yes, there's a risk you might be taken advantage of. But here's the beauty of the thing. Here's the beauty of the thing. If you are living all and only how you want to live, then you can't be taken advantage of. You hear me? If you are living all and only how you want to live, then you can't be taken advantage of. If my intention is to be servant, and then someone treats me as if I'm just a servant, you know what? I'm not being taken advantage of. Because that's what I really want. I, in fact, can tell when, in fact, in my own heart and in your heart, we're not comfortable being servants. You know how I can tell? Because you'll say, he just treated me just like I was a servant. So, well, I'm not. You're not. What are you? I don't know what I am. I don't like the idea of thinking of myself fundamentally as a servant, because then sometimes I get treated just like a servant. But if that were my identity, if that's how I really understood myself, if I understood that Jesus is reproducing his life as servant in me, then I got treated as a servant. That ought to be a time of going, yeah, his life is being reproduced in me, and someone treated me just like they treated him. They treated him like a servant. They're treating me like a servant. Maybe I'm getting out of the way and Jesus' life is being seen in me. And yeah, there's a risk. You might be taken advantage of. Now, if I saw myself as a servant, does this mean that I have to do whatever anyone asks me to do? If I get to the place where, okay, I understand this thing, but if I see myself as a servant, does this mean that I have to do whatever someone asks me to do? I think the answer to that question is no. But I'm almost afraid to answer that question because so many of us are so far from even getting close to that, doing everything that somebody asks us to do. We're so very far from that. The truth is that the struggle I have, let me just be honest with you, when I think about that question, just so do I do what they want me to do? There's two things that go through my heart when I get behind the question. The first thing is, well, I don't want to do that. That's the reason why I'm asking, do I have to do everything they ask me to do? I don't want to do that. Why don't I want to do that? Because if I do that, then I'm acting just like a servant. I don't want to act like a servant. So the question behind that is, who do I really think myself to be? The second thing that I find going on in my own soul when I wrestle with, do I have to do what everyone asks me to do? I realize, when I'm honest, that what I'm really concerned with is, how can I leverage my serving so that it will make me look best? So when I look at, do I have to do what everyone asks me to do? What I'm really asking is, can I be selective in the things that I do so that I get to serve in the best possible ways for me? Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm just trying to be honest about how I'm wrestling within my own soul. I think most people are not so under the demands of others that their entire life would be given over to serving. I don't think most of us live anywhere close to that. And so, do I have to do whatever anybody asks me to do? I think the question behind that is, why isn't that you want to be a servant? Why don't you want to do that? And then secondly, why is it that you want to be so selective in your serving? What do you think? Do you understand what I'm saying? I want to be selective in my serving. I want to make sure that if I do what that person wants me to do, that I get some credit for it, that I get some recognition for it. I don't want to just serve and not get anything out of it, because then I would be just a servant. I want something more than that. But so, no, I don't. It doesn't mean that you will always do whatever anybody... Jesus is a good example. The religious leaders, Jesus is going everywhere and serving. And the religious leaders say, hey, we want you to do this thing. We want you to jump through our hoop. Jesus goes, no, not going to do that. They say, we just want you to give us a sign. And he goes, I'm not giving you any sign. And then he proceeds to do miracles. It's like, that's what they were asking for. Why aren't you, you said you're not doing, well, he's not jumping through their hoop because they were manipulating him to get him to do what they wanted so they could give him credibility. That's the wrong kind of serving. Jesus goes, I'm not doing that. This isn't a real need that's being addressed. This is not a real area of serving. You just want me to jump through the hoops so that I can be on your good side. I'm not going to do that. A servant doesn't worry about getting on somebody's good side or bad side. A servant just worries about serving. And so Jesus is free to say no to some things. That's manipulative. That is a different agenda. That's not a genuine need. So Jesus is free to say that. But candidly, I don't think most of us are even close to that, at being at risk of giving in. One of Jesus' favorite things to say is, what can I do for you? And he even says it to the disciples when they're arguing about greatness. So, if I saw myself as a servant, does this mean that I have to do whatever anyone asks? No, not necessarily. Here's the third question. If I am not yet seeing myself as servant, should I just start serving? If I don't yet see myself as servant, should I just start serving? And my answer to that is, maybe not. Maybe not. Let me tell you why. If you don't get to the place where you admit that there's a heart problem and you simply start the doing, then you miss it. You miss it. You're just going to be pretending to be a servant. You're just acting like a servant. You don't really hear it yet. You don't really understand it. It's got to be a heart issue. In fact, turn back with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 8. This is where Charlie was a few weeks ago talking about the example of the Macedonians. I think this helps me get my hands around this idea of if I'm not yet serving, what do I need to start with? In chapter 8, starting in verse 4, Paul is talking about the Macedonians and says that they were begging us earnestly for the favor of taking part in the relief of the saints. The Macedonians were begging for an opportunity to serve. Why? Verse 5. And this, not as we expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord, and then by the will of God they gave themselves to us, and then they begged us for the opportunity to serve. And I think that's what needs to happen. First, you have to give yourself to God, and that is find your identity in Jesus. Find your life in Him. And then you have to give yourself to others, that is identifying myself as a servant. I am here in relationships, whether it's with my wife or with my children or with my coworkers or with others in the church or with the people who I meet in my neighborhood or those who I bump into in the market. I am here fundamentally as a servant. And then I can give myself to particular acts of service. But if I don't get the first two parts right, then I just do stuff. And that's not it. With the mindset of a servant, if I recognize that's who I am in Christ, then the environment of service goes with me wherever I go. Wherever I go, there's the opportunity to serve. And I'm not looking for the what. I am just there as servant. And if feet are dirty, I'll wash them. I don't serve here or there. I don't make a selective choice. Okay, I have 20 minutes extra every week after my busy packed schedule, and it would be good if I did some serving things. So what can I do with those 20 minutes and find some choice serving? No, that's not it. Serving is about understanding this is who I am, and so wherever I go, I am there as servant, and then I'm yielding to the Spirit and understanding how it is the Spirit might want to press Jesus' life out through me into the lives of others in richness. In Galatians chapter 5, back in Galatians when we were there, Paul was talking about how Jesus has set us free. He has brought us into this free life. But the freedom is not a freedom then to just live for yourself. The freedom, he says, is in love we get to serve one another. What's that about? Jesus is reproducing his life in us. The freedom that he gives us is now to grow up to live like him. And that would look like, in love, serving others. Because that's who we are. That's who he's making us to be. As I was thinking about this whole message, what came to mind was the opening scene of one of my favorite movies. The movie's called Princess Bride. See, and now I know that you all have seen it, right? Because you all go, ah. Those that have seen it, they all go, ah. Because it's a delightful, fun kind of movie. The movie opens with two characters, Wesley, a young man, and Buttercup, a young woman. And the narrator is telling the story of Wesley and Buttercup. And Wesley serves Buttercup. I mean, she will ask him to do something. Please get me that pitcher. And his response is, as you wish. Yeah, those of you that have seen the movie know. He says, as you wish. And then she asks him something else. Would you do this? And he says, as you wish. And then she asks something else, and he says, as you wish. Time and time again, she asks him to do something, and his response is, as you wish. And what becomes really clear is that it is his character and nature to respond that way. He's not doing stuff. He is being real. And the narrator explains to us that, well, when Wesley says, as you wish, what he's really saying is, I love you. And she recognizes that she loves him and he loves her. And what you see there is love expressing itself in serving that is an actual outflow of the identity of the person. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's not tacked on, pasted on the outside. Wesley's not trying to score points. He is genuinely who he is. It's just who I am. I love you, and because of that, I am your servant. So when you ask me to do something, my first response is, as you wish. I think that's a pretty good picture of the way that Jesus lived. Because of his great love for us, when he steps onto the scene, he comes as servant. And when we say, Jesus, can you do this? He says, as you wish. Jesus, would you do this? As you wish. Jesus, these are hungry people. What will you do? I'll feed them. As you wish. Jesus, this person is lame. This person is blind. As you wish. And Jesus serves. And he is inviting us into that life. Not a different life. That life. And when our hearts are captured by the love of God, his love for us and his love for others, and we begin to understand this transformation that Jesus is doing in us to reproduce his life in us, we will begin to see ourselves fundamentally as servants. And wherever we go, in love, as the life of Jesus flows out of us, people will begin to hear these words from us. As you wish. I'm your servant. I think that's the who question that's at the heart of serving. Let's pray. Jesus, forgive me for thinking that sharing your life somehow means I can be different than you. And thank you for opening my eyes in little ways to see that sharing your life is no less than being the kind of person you are. I am so grateful that you are the servant who's come to rescue us. I am at times not so very grateful that means that I get to grow up to be like a servant also. But I'm beginning to see it. I'm beginning to see you reproducing your life in me. I'm beginning to find my identity as a servant like you. For us, there would come such great joy and freedom if serving was not what we did, but being a servant was who we really were. Work this in us for our good and for your glory, I pray.